Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another great episode of the Weekly Pulse podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO, and your host for the next 60-plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues related to retirement, markets, technology, personal finance, healthcare, and so much more. We've got another great show. We're going to be talking target date funds this week, but not just the same target date fund conversation, talking about performance, talking about active versus passive. We've got a very special guest, Miss Gretchen Tai, who's a portfolio manager and principal with Secor Asset Management here in New York City, is going to be joining us to give us her Christmas wish list. We know it's a little bit late for Christmas, but she published a great white paper, and we're going to talk to her about the next iteration of target date funds. And of course, we're going to be joined by our great contributors from around the globe. So sit back, relax, and get set for this great episode of The Weekly Pulse. Well, we're going to kick things off, as we always do, by starting at looking at social media trends. And joining us, of course, for this awesome segment is Senior Finance Editor, Mr. Devin Banerjee. He's from LinkedIn. Hey, Devin, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hope you had a great week. It's getting cold, or it's really cold here on the East Coast, and we're expecting snow this weekend in New York City and surrounding vicinity, so people are kind of batting down the hatches.
Yeah, I can imagine. I have to go to New York at some point, but I'm waiting a couple of weeks until all this is over.
Yeah, I think you should. And all I can say is, if you're snowed in, what better way to catch up is to sit and listen to this episode of the show. So with that being said, Devin, what's been top of mind for you and the folks at LinkedIn?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, typically, Jeff, on social media, we get some great anecdotal-driven news and storytelling. This week, I've actually got a crop of some really powerful data-driven news that I wanted to share with you guys, and that's sparking a lot of conversation on LinkedIn and across social media. The first was this report from Bloomberg, quite inspiring data that shows millennial women, so women aged 25 to 34, are looking for work and getting jobs at the highest rate in almost two decades. So young women have actually accounted for 86% of the growth in the workforce since December 2015, so roughly in the past 3 years. And so generally what we're seeing is that women are really driving the labor market recovery, even going back since the recession and since the financial crisis. And we've actually seen men not really recover as quickly to those pre-recession levels of workforce participation. So some hypotheses from economists and labor market experts about this include some cultural trends. So younger women we're seeing are delaying getting married and having kids, and also now we're seeing they're more likely than young men to have a college degree. So that may be why they are succeeding in the workforce more. Economic trends, you know, the industries that are adding the most workers, like health services, for example, they do feature many kind of more traditional women-dominated jobs. And then, the recent bump in wages we're seeing could also be allowing working mothers to better afford childcare and to be more willing to enter the workforce. So a lot of hypotheses there, but the data is showing that women are looking for work and getting jobs at a very high rate, the highest rate in two decades. So some good news there.
Yeah, absolutely. A good sign. Now we just got to get anybody who wants a job, hopefully they're in a position that they can find something as well, because I know it can be tough out there for families. And you look at what's happening with this government shutdown as an example. Some people are really struggling to make ends meet. So hopefully those themes that you mentioned continue for women. And we can also, if you're out there looking for a job, you can find at least something to take some of the burden off.
Yeah. And speaking of the burden, you know, this next story that we saw a real, real strong reaction to is GoFundMe, which is the site that allows people to raise money for certain causes. It turns out about a third of the $5 billion raised on GoFundMe in the past 9 years mm-hmm. is actually going toward medical expenses. And so this is something we had heard about And I think GoFundMe had shared a bit, but it came out and said about a third of the money being raised is going to medical expenses. So just a really strong sign that the cost of healthcare and the level of medical expenses is really rising to a point that individuals are struggling and having to turn to online sites and their community to pay for their health services, which is really scary. You know, GoFundMe itself said it did not expect healthcare to be such an active area. The CEO, Rob Solomon, said it saddens him that this is a reality and that every day, you know, they see these challenges that people are facing. So just sort of a counterbalancing data point there to remind people that even though the labor market is strong and wages are picking up a bit, healthcare, as we've talked about in the past, Jeff, still really stands out as that real top of mind concern for most ordinary people.
Yeah, and I think last week, if I do recall, you know, the days run together, quite frankly. I think you and I spoke about the price of pharmaceutical drugs
yep.
going up. That was last week, one of your themes for last week. And, you know, it's just really sad. We have the obviously the greatest, in my opinion, I'm just going to say the greatest country in the world. And it doesn't mean that others are not good and capable, but we should have a great health system. And the fact that people are really struggling, you know, I touched on it this week. I did a segment for Roads to Retirement. We talked about rowing, and I kind of teed it up with what we talked about last week, which is healthcare is a very big expense when you're a retiree and when you're on a fixed income. And, you know, there are steps certainly you can do to improve your health, but this seems like the tide is not ebbing at all, and something really needs to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It's quite scary. And related to this point, the third story I wanted to share with you is something we saw some of the older segments of our membership talk about on LinkedIn a lot this week, which is that, you know, caregivers, people who do spend their time looking after elderly parents or relatives or others are really looking for more help from their employers. So a study from Harvard Business School found that employers really underestimate how hard it is for employees and their staff to balance work and caregiving duties. The study found that almost 3/4 of U.S. workers actually have some caregiving duties. 32% of U.S. workers have left a job because they couldn't balance their work with caregiving duties. And more than 3/4 of workers say that caregiving duties prohibit them from optimal performance at work. So a real issue that I think we don't talk about a lot, even in big companies like the ones I've worked for, I never really spend time talking to colleagues who have caregiving duties about that work and that burden. And so this is certainly something that it's in everyone's interest. It should be in employers' interest because employees are not working optimally at an optimal level. And, you know, in certain segments, and certain sectors like technology companies, you know, we have seen some real great advancements in perks and benefits for employees around this area. But I think employers need to think about this a bit more.
Yeah, and especially, you know, we've talked about this on the show time and time again. The country's aging. We're not getting any younger. I think, you know, the number of new children is not at the rate that it once was, certainly during the baby boom generation, maybe even during my generation, things are slowing down. So we have an aging workforce, and this is obviously a big part of that. And you don't necessarily have to be an older person to have aging parents in today's day and age, right?
Right.
I mean, you could be the son or daughter to aging parents and still be in your 20s or 30s now. You know, people are having children younger. So I think this is a big issue. In some ways, and I don't want to mischaracterize, but in some ways it's similar to raising a child because, you know, as you get older, you do need help. I mean, there's no doubt if, ands, or buts. And as a child, you know, or as a son or daughter and growing up, you know, you want to take care of your parents who have taken care of you. So I think this is a big issue. It's another one of these issues. Unfortunately, Devin, there's so many things to have to wrestle with.
I know.
You know, it's not easy for employers. It's not easy for government officials. It's just, you know, there's so much to deal with. But, you know, we've got to start chipping away at some of these mega issues.
Absolutely.
Well, always, Devin, always a pleasure. Great to catch up with you, and wish you and your wife a very nice weekend, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Seth. Sounds good. Take care.
Bye. Perfection is perfected, so I'm a lad, I'm understanding from a young G's perspective. And before me, they got a trick, I have to find a contraceptive. You never know, she could be earning her man and learning her man, and at the same time, burning her man. Now when she burning, I'ma chill for a minute. Welcome back, and now it's time to talk a little technology and maybe some entertainment news as well. Joining us from The Motley Fool, she is the technology reporter there, Ms. Natalie Walters. Hey, Nat, how are you?
Hi, doing good. Doing great. Lots of stuff that's kind of happening this week in the tech world.
Yeah, well, you know, I wanted to tee it up because I think, you know, last week I got some real positive feedback on – yeah, I always get positive feedback on the show, but in terms of your segment, people really liked the Golden Globes angle that we had. And I'm happy to partake. You know, I do follow popular culture, as you know. I mean, I'm very big into rapping and rappers and news and you name it. So I'm right there with you. So what's been top of mind for you this week? I have a couple of ideas, but I'm going to let you go.
Yeah. Well, you know, Netflix is my favorite company to cover. I think it's because I've always had a fascination with movies. You know, I was an extra in some movies last year. I just think they're fascinating. So I really like understanding the business. So Netflix reported earnings yesterday, Thursday, after the bell. And it was a mixed result. Their earnings came in above estimates, but the revenue was just below. And so there's, you know, there's always two sides to the Netflix investors, where some people think it's just great, and, you know, more and more people are watching it. You know, it continues to grow subscribers, and now there's a big opportunity to grow internationally. But there's other people who say, you know, they're just going further into debt, and there's no guarantee that it will eventually balance out, you know, that they'll eventually have enough subscribers where they're self-funding. And so some people think it's, you know, basically a sandcastle that's not really standing on anything firm, and that it could all crumble one day. You know, it's possible it could all work out, but it's not exactly guaranteed. So it's always interesting to see their earnings come out and, you know, their cash flow and everything. And another interesting thing from this report is that for the first time, they released some viewership figures, which is not something they ever do have ever done before. And 80 million people, they believe, have watched that movie we talked about, Bird Box, which you weren't a fan of, but it apparently has really gone viral, which is a really incredible number. And of course, it's easier to watch something from home than going to buy a $15 ticket at the movie theater. So there's a difference there, but it's definitely showing, you know, the power of Netflix and the power of high quality original content that's, you know, stories that haven't been told before, you know, really doing new stuff there. So there, you know, it's a mixed quarter, but it wasn't terrible. It wasn't their best quarter, but it wasn't a terrible quarter for them.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, thanks for that. And I mean, I love this intersection too, because it is a content-driven world. And I think you do such a great job following this for us and for obviously for your magazine, for your, not magazine, but your site. And, you know, I know that it's very unique for them to release viewership numbers, and kudos to people who like Bird Box. You know, for me, it just kind of reminded me of The Happening, and that was a movie with Mark Wahlberg from about 10 years ago, which coincidentally was on last night, and I watched it. You know, good for them for disclosing some of that information, and certainly they felt that it supported their thesis, which I'm sure is the reason why. I did get some complaints this week from friends of mine who said that you know, they were surprised by the increase in the subscriber fee went up slightly, I guess 10 to 15%. And my response was, where do you think they're going to recoup the money on the $8 billion that they spent in new content? Right? I mean, there's no free lunch.
And I, you know, they've told us it's going to go up each year. Our content budget will go up each year. And usually they give us a number. You know, last year they said $8 billion, you know, 7.58 billion. And this year they didn't give us a specific number, which I almost think is worrisome, because it might be such a large amount they're expecting to spend that they don't want to worry people with how much is going up. So I think that's going to be a huge number this year. And yeah, they raised their plan. They have three plans and they were all raised by $1 to $2. And I was definitely expecting that just because they tend to raise it about every year. So I knew it had been slightly over a year this past October, but I thought they would wait a little bit longer. It came a little sooner than I was expecting. I was thinking more, you know, somewhere between May and August of this year. But, you know, they have to, like you said, they have to recoup those losses. And I think they're going to spend really big on content this year with Disney coming into the mix and Apple. So I think they really needed that extra cash as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think you mentioned before, and I'll just give you my opinion for whatever it's worth. You know, I'm not a stock analyst, nor am I a technology analyst. But, you know, they actually have a lot of subscribers. They're earning money. So it's not like it's a complete house of cards, pun fully intended there, because they are getting subscribers. They are getting revenue in the door. You know, I think when you're trying to get A-list movie stars, of which Sandra Bullock, John Malkovich, you know, and others that they're getting for their programming, and those things cost money. And then you've got it in order to compete with the Hollywood studios. I mean, you have to have the CGI, you have to have good scripts, you have to have the production. So, you know, those things do cost money. But so far, they do seem to be doing pretty well in terms of meeting the demand. And I'm wondering how other subscription services such as like HBO Go, Showtime, Amazon Amazon Prime or Amazon Prime Movie is doing in relation.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because this week there's been another interesting story about Netflix. It's been all Netflix this week, where on Monday, Hulu released their documentary about the botched Fyre Festival that happened a few years ago. And then today, Netflix released their documentary on the Fyre Festival. So Netflix had announced its release date, you know, I want to say in the past month, so everybody knew it was coming this Friday. Hulu hadn't marketed it, so it just dropped it on Monday, and it created this frenzy of people, you know, oh, Hulu's obviously dropping theirs 5 days before Netflix. It's a sort of competitive move there. Mm-hmm. So that was a fun thing to just follow, and I can tell you, I watched the Hulu one, and it was good, and I was decently pleased with it, but I started watching the Netflix one today, just a little bit, and I can already tell you the Netflix one is much, much better in my opinion. Just more details, better explained, more interviews, more shots. So if you followed that, I guess you call it scandal of the Fyre Festival, I would definitely recommend watching the Netflix one.
Interesting.
If you're willing to pay the extra $1 or $2 in subscription fees right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's definitely people who are breathing down or trying to breathe down Netflix's back, so to speak, in terms of providing content. And you can't blame them for trying to, you know, beat them to the punch. And I would imagine that, you know, the Hollywood seems to be a small world, you know, not one that I'm a part of course. But, you know, the writers, I'm sure people that write for Netflix and write documentaries and do things also may do things for Hulu. I mean, you know, you don't want to be beholden. I would think that as a script writer or an actor, you would want to kind of float between all the platforms. That just seems to make sense to me as a someone who's been a consultant who is, you know, in my business, you know, you want to be equal to everybody in terms of the asset managers and the record keepers and the providers in the space. So, you know, it just seems that it's going to come down to the timing, the marketing. The quality certainly has to be good, and I'm sure it's going to be very competitive from now until the end of time.
Yeah, it's really, if you want your content seen, Netflix is the place to be. You know, 80 million people saw that Bird Box movie. That's insane, and that's only in about a month that it's been out. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I definitely think there's people that are working at all these same companies. You know, they kind of switch around people. There's a lot of Disney people that are now working for Netflix. So that'll create an interesting dynamic as Disney enters the space.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I mean, we have seen kind of finishing up the segment, we have seen people kind of gravitate towards these content deliverers, you know, leaving the, you know, I wonder how the theaters are doing. I'm assuming they're not doing that great, but there is something to be said for watching for example, Star Wars or Solo, a Star Wars story, or one of these movies on a big screen with a great sound system. And that it sounds like, you know, for certain movies, it's a great, that's very powerful. It can be very powerful. Whereas, you know, watching your home, yes, people have, you know, a bass and certain speakers and things like that, but I don't think anything yet replicates the theater experience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd say I go 2 or 3 times a year when a movie is just really calling to me, but I'm somebody who likes to watch from my home, but who knows, maybe we'll see Netflix starting to release content in the theaters this year or next year.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, Nat, we're going to have to leave it at that. Good luck in the snowstorm. When this airs, we'll know whether we have 3, 6, or 12 inches. And thanks, as always, for catching up with us. Very insightful. And we love the crossover content. We're actually getting into the mainstream. Retirement, technology, all going into the mainstream, courtesy of Miss Natalie Walters. Have a good weekend, Nat.
Thanks so much. You too. Talk to you next week.
Perfection is perfected, so I'ma let them understand from a young G's perspective. And before me, they got a trick, I have to find a contraceptive. You never know, she could be earning a man.
Welcome back, and now it's time for our market segment. Join me now from Delphi Digital. He's a principal there, Mr. Kevin Kelly. Hey, Kev, how are you?
Doing well, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's been an interesting week in the market. Before we go there, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge, I know that you saw the news that Mr. Jack Bogle passed away, and obviously that's a passing of a legend and someone who had such a major impact on our industry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't even think legend begins to really surmise what he did for the investment industry. So loss of a real, real titan there for sure.
Yeah, and he had such an impact on so many lives, both of his generation and probably future generations. So obviously our condolences to his family and to the Vanguard family and shareholders and people everywhere. But that being said, the market, you know, moves on, and it's been kind of an interesting week. You know, we had the beginning of the year, the end of the year, you know, you and Oliver and George had talked about just the volatility and had really taken a nosedive. And it looks like things have really turned around these last this past week. How does it shape up from your perspective?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of dynamics that are going on right now that have kind of given the, you know, equity markets a bit of a bounce here. If we start in the U.S., and I do want to touch on the international kind of outlook in the near term, or at least what I'm seeing, because I think that's a really interesting space that's worth, you know, a double look, especially in emerging markets. But starting off with the U.S., I mean, you've seen the S&P 500 really kind of rally back, you know, retracing a good amount. Not obviously all the losses that it's had, you know, recently since its late September peak there, but late September 2018 peak. But I think that the kind of bottom line is, it's still a little bit too early to tell if this is a sustained rally higher, if it's more just kind of a dead cat bounce, a technical bounce. There's a number of technical indicators that the S&P 500 is encroaching upon. And one of those is looking at, you know, earnings estimates and the changes in earning estimates. I think this coming earnings season that we're just starting to get into, there's been some decent reports that have come out already. And I think the bar has been set a little bit lower than historically in the past for this Q4, because everyone kind of has already started to discount, you know, a slowing earnings growth outlook for the U.S. equity market. The dollar's also had gotten a pretty good bid recently. And I think that dollar rally is really kind of what's sparked me to look back into emerging markets, because I think they're certainly worth a double take right now. And the potential opportunity there is really heavily predicated on the dollar. And what I mean by that is, if you look at where emerging markets are trading, they've started to gain a little bit of momentum recently, especially compared to U.S. equities. They're gaining some momentum. A big reason why there's been weakness in emerging markets is because, of course, of this dollar rally, a lot of dollar-denominated debt. You have things like oil that are priced, you know, in dollars. And so I think if you get, you know, some weakness in the dollar, looking at certain momentum indicators, you're starting to see a little bit of that crack in the dollar come through. If you do see a weaker dollar, that could have a catalyst of the Fed coming out being a little bit more dovish, or, you know, other global central banks. If you see a convergence in global central bank policy, I think what's really sustained the dollar rally has been, you know, the Fed out in front hiking rates, you know, heading into 2019. if you start to see a little bit of that trail off and you see some weakness in the dollar, emerging markets could certainly bounce back. I mean, they're trading at valuations that are inexpensive relative to history. And there is some concerns about China, and China obviously being a big part of the emerging market story. But I think there's also, you know, some potential opportunities if you wanted to stay away from more of the China trade, because tariffs and all that is still uncertain, even though we've gotten a little bit more, I guess you'd say, bullish on markets, given some of the tariff talk that's been going on recently. You could even play it by just looking, you know, I think Latin America is a really, really interesting space to look at right now that's really suffered from dollar strength. And there's, you know, a number of ETFs that allow you to get maybe some emerging market exposure, that growth exposure, without necessarily having to be as exposed to China as some may want to be. So there's a number of different things. I think, you know, there's always opportunities everywhere. I think emerging markets is one that I've been looking at recently that I think is one that could certainly shape up if you do start to see a crack in King dollar, you know, moving forward.
Thanks for that, Kevin. And, you know, one of the great things, there's so many great things to having all of our contributors on in this segment. But one of the great things about having a segment in which you're the only contributor is that we can go in a couple of different areas, and that being crypto. So you laid out the macro for us. And you know, everyone knows who's followed the show knows your experience as an equity strategist and someone who knows the macro extremely well. Now you're sitting in the catbird seat, and as it relates to crypto, can you put your crypto hat on and now kind of give us a look at that while we've got some time in the segment?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been a decently quiet week in terms of, you know, crypto volatility. Maybe I'm a little bit jaded to it, but there hasn't been anything too abnormal in the price action within crypto. One of the more notable things that's gone on recently that, you know, definitely does warrant some attention and some clarification is this week, there was a planned hard fork for Ethereum. So as we've talked about in the past, basically what that means is a change in the underlying code, the underlying protocol. For Ethereum, kind of, you can think of it as almost like an upgrade to Ethereum that was supposed to take place this week. Very, very big news. It ended up getting delayed for a really interesting reason. There was a security auditing firm that came out and actually did this deep dive analysis on the new code that was going to be implemented. And what they found was that there were a number of kind of security vulnerabilities that could threaten in the Ethereum network. And so I think it's a double-edged sword. What's really cool is that they were actually able, the core developers were able to delay that hard fork change till I believe late February is now the new date. And some people look at that as a weakness and say, you know, if a security audit firm can come out and find these security vulnerabilities, you know, isn't that kind of a bearish, shouldn't that set a bearish tone for crypto and crypto prices moving forward? And I would kind of almost argue the opposite in that the fact that a lot of this stuff is open source, it's again an emerging technology, but you have the open source ability for people to come in and actually, you know, audit this code and come out with different reports and really strengthen the underlying protocols. I think that's actually a really cool and unique feature that you don't see in other asset classes. So that was kind of the Ethereum hard fork delay. It was probably the biggest thing that people were watching this week in the crypto markets. And so there's been a little bit of volatility within the Ether price, but nothing too crazy to write home about. I think, you know, life goes on, and the crypto markets really haven't been too spooked by what's going on.
Yeah, really, really interesting. You had to wear the asset management hat, the strategist hat, but now you have to have the technology hat to boot. And, you know, I think there's, you know, obviously it's the Wild West it's a new frontier, I guess.
It makes every day interesting, that's for sure.
Hey, let me ask you a question as we're, you know, kind of we started off with Jack Bogle. But here's an interesting stat that I don't know if you saw this, but I saw this in Financial Times, and I think Morningstar had put out some information that U.S. active funds suffered $143 billion exodus in December. And since 2008, it was about $300 billion that active funds shed during the year to passive funds. Any, you know, I'm just kind of hitting this with you, so the audience should know that, you know, Kevin and I don't typically go over what we're going to talk about. You know, we all know each other pretty well, but just some first blush at thoughts about that.
Yeah, no, I actually hadn't seen that stat, but it's in line with a lot of the commentary that's come out over, you know, the last couple of years. With that kind of move away from active towards passive. I mean, listen, I think longer term, kind of the outlook for that industry is I think people are going to move much more towards, and this is for kind of asset management, I think people are going to move much more towards kind of a barbell approach where you use, you know, the vanguards of the world to kind of have this core portfolio, right? Like an S&P 500, there's a lot of active mutual funds out there that certainly, you know, take active bets, and they're not closet indexers, like as we would call them. But there are a lot of active funds out there that primarily, I mean, pretty much track, you know, indices like the S&P 500 with slight variations in terms of whether it's sector overweights or maybe they have a little bit more exposure to, you know, Apple or technology, the technology sector, for example. I think it's going to become much more kind of bifurcated in that you're going to have this core approach where you enlist something like a Vanguard fund. And then on the other end is active management becomes much more kind of that barbell approach where, you know, they are taking these concentrated kind of core, maybe even thematic type bets. And when you're constructing a portfolio, if you're thinking about this from whether you're a financial consultant or, you know, private wealth manager, whatever it may be, this core satellite approach is really interesting because then you could kind of pick the different, let's say you had a core portfolio that tracked overall equity markets, and then you had, you know, a couple active managers that you took bets on that you believed in kind of their thematic overweights or whatever it may be. I think that's kind of how this industry almost has to evolve, because there is a lot of money that's chased these passive strategies, and people have kind of come around to realize that, you know, if the equity markets from a passive standpoint are very correlated with what active managers are actually doing, then why would you pay, you know, these 2 and 20 fees when you could pretty much replicate, let's call it 85% to 90%, you know, that exposure yourself for a much, much cheaper, cheaper rate. So I think that's kind of how longer term this is going to play out. But it's certainly really interesting to see, you know, again, you see these headlines and these stats that come across the wire of, you know, how much money is really actually flowing out of active and some of the headwinds that the active management, you know, industry faces.
Well, good. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for weighing in. And we always appreciate your insight into the markets and cryptocurrency and just all things investment management. Wish you and your family a very nice weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thank you, too.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Death row is the label that pays, man. Unfadable, so please don't try to fake this. But back to the lecture at hand.
Perfection is perfected, so I'm gonna let them understand. From a young G's, welcome back, and we've got a really great interview segment this week. We're joined by the portfolio manager and partner, a portfolio manager partner with Secor and Asset Management, Miss Gretchen Tai. And Gretchen, thanks for joining us on the show this week.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And you know, I want to get you to talk a little bit about your background, but, you know, by way of introduction of this segment, obviously, target date funds are a huge part of what we do in the defined contribution world. They are gaining more and more the lion's share of plan assets and therefore have significant importance. And, you know, I've known Secor Asset Management and you for a long period of time, and you recently authored a white paper around Christmas time that we'll link to when we post this, as we post the show. But you really had a grown-up perspective, and I put that in quotations. But before we get into your perspective on target defense, which I love bringing new and thoughtful ideas to our audience, would you mind just giving a little bit about your background? Because you have really an interesting perspective.
Sure. So before joining Secor, I was actually a plan sponsor for a long time, more than a decade, and actually implemented my first iteration of custom target day fund back in 2007. So that was a long time ago, and it's been a passion for me for a long time. But you mentioned about the paper, and what prompted me to write this paper called A Grown-Up with Christmas List for a target day fund, and kind of my wish list for the next generation target day fund, was really because of an exchange that I had with a friend a couple of years ago. And I'm sure this happened to you too, Jeff, that for many of us who work in finance or investments, that we get requests for investment advice from friends and family. And that's what happened to me a few years ago when my friend reached out to me and asked me to take a look at the investment options of her 401k provided by her company and help her pick the best investment option for her. And I said to my friend, of course, you know, I'd be happy to do that. I didn't think that it was going to be difficult at all. But this exercise actually turned out to be much more difficult than I expected. And it was really through, and kudos to my friend as well for asking all sorts of challenging questions that really prompted me to think back on self-reflection of what Target Day Fund really is, and is it going to be enough for the next generation of us who are using it as a main retirement savings vehicle going into retirement.
So, Gretchen, I love it, and I can definitely relate how I've been, you know, you've been at the family dinners, and you get kind of, or friend New Year's Eve parties, and I get cornered. Hey, what should I do with my money? And, you know, Target Day funds are always top of mind for me, but I love your perspective, and actually being a plan sponsor, I think it really adds additional value to consideration when looking at these products. So what about the current, these current off the shelf, these current versions, do you think is inadequate?
I think that the design of Target Day Fund, if we think about when Target Day Funds were designed 20, 25 years ago, it was an innovation, and it was actually a good product for what it was supposed to be. And so if we think back 20, 25 years ago, Target Day Fund and DC plans were used or designed to be a supplement mm-hmm. to the main retirement vehicle, which is pension. So 20, 25 years ago, most people still have pension. And so that was really what it was designed for. But fast forward to where we are today, most people actually don't have pension anymore. And it's really that design flawed in that it doesn't provide a floor for safety that could potentially be a challenge in the next generation. So, for example, by far the biggest challenge for a Target Day Fund user is for someone to retire right before a downturn. And so if somebody has a pension plan, they're still expected to live out the pension, and they may not touch the Target Day Fund as main draw for withdrawal for source of cash or source of income. And that's still going to be okay, but that is not going to be the situation for most people as we enter the decumulation phase for Target Day Funds in the next 10 years.
Absolutely. I think this is a huge challenge for the industry. And to your point, many, many, many Americans are retiring today. And some don't have the luxury of picking and choosing exactly when, in terms of the market conditions and whether there's market volatility or not market volatility, to begin withdrawing assets. And for many Americans, secondary to their home, or you know, this is probably their largest pool of assets. So let's fast forward. You know, in terms of the thesis of your white paper, how do you build a more efficient Target Day Fund portfolio from your perspective?
So I think the most urgent challenge, like I mentioned earlier, is really this drawdown right before the recession. And so for most of us who are professional investors, it is practically impossible to predict when the next recession is going to be. So I think it's not reasonable for the Target Day Fund or for any of us to sort of expect the average person to be able to avoid a recession risk and manage their or actively manage their Target Day Fund to manage that market volatility. And so for the next Target Day Fund, next generation Target Day Fund, I would really like to see more sophisticated risk management built into the Target Day Fund to navigate this market volatility, as opposed to sort of leaving the participants to decide for themselves. And this is not a unsolvable investment problem. These are the things that many pension plans have done for themselves. You can have more sophisticated risk targeting, more sophisticated hedging strategies. We just need to take that professional management and overlay it on the current version of the Target Day Fund to lessen the severe drawdown risk.
And so,
one of the things that people don't talk about, for example, is that in the Target Day Fund, in the assumptions, we're still assuming people to say they're going to withdraw a certain percentage of their assets. And so, you know, say in the 2007, 2008 timeframe, when the market dropped 50%, it is very practically impossible for a retiree to say, I'm going to be able to cut my spending by 50% just so that I don't run out of money. So what happens a lot is that people don't end up reducing their spending as much as they try to kind of accommodate the drop in the AUM of their total assets. So what happens is that their spending ratio is going to increase, and not because they're living extravagantly, but because of the market downturn. And that is a really risky situation that we really need to highlight to the participants, and so that they can prepare for themselves as well and also be much, much more aggressive in cutting their spending.
So I love the, pardon me, I'm getting over a cold. But let me ask you, one of the things that you talked about is, you know, communication, education, in addition to, so solving the investment problem, so that, you know, you can manage the investment problem on behalf of the participant, and but also communicating and educating people, because it's not just an either or. There's a combination of things that have to happen. You can create a much more efficient portfolio, a better target date fund, but also, you know, people still need to be educated by and large about retirement, about savings, about budgeting, doing all these things, in addition to having a good portfolio.
Absolutely right. And I think that was definitely one of the biggest aha moments I had when I was going through this exercise with my friend. So as you know, in the industry, we spend a lot of time trying to optimize or maximize the portfolio. And there was a lot of debate on glide to, glide through, what the shape of the glide should be, how much diversification is really desirable, et cetera, et cetera. But when I was kind of taking a step back and looking at it through the lens of a participant, I think the biggest questions that people wanted to know is how much money do I actually need and how much risk should I take? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the risk targeting or type of questionnaire self-service things that we have in the financial planning tool is actually the opposite of what people need. So sometimes a typical question might be, you know, how much risk can you tolerate? You know, can you tolerate your portfolio to go up and down, you know, 10%, 20% and still be able to sleep through the night? But if we ask the question differently, you know, are you willing to tolerate your portfolio to go up or down 10, 20% just so that you can not take the risk of running out of money at retirement? I think people actually would behave or answer those questions very differently. And so I think there is a translation gap that we have in the industry, kind of bridging the gap of the target date design, but also be able to translate that to something that an average participant can understand. And that mainly is, do I have enough? If I don't, how much do I need and how do I get there? And what's the appropriate risk? And am I taking actually more risk in retirement by not taking enough investment risk? And so that's a level of translation and education that we desperately need in my mind.
Well, I would agree with you. And I think we also use too much jargon in our, and I was just reading a piece on this piece this morning, right? In our industry, you know, we have things like beta and alpha and expense ratio, and those things mean a lot to sophisticated investors like yourself. And you know what? The American people are not stupid. They're smart people, but you know they don't they're not trying to be well educated as it relates to investments. They're trusting fund managers and others and delegating to them to manage on their behalf. So I think to your point, we've got to work on getting that translation gap or covering that translation gap so that people really understand just the basics. What does it mean? What does it mean if I take this amount out? What is this budget? What is this? How's this going to impact my budget? What do I need at retirement? What don't I need at retirement? Because originally when target date funds were created, going back to your earlier point, you know, 20, 25 years ago, they were really sold as set it and forget it, something that would make Ron Popeil, the advertiser, very proud, right? If you just invest in this particular product and this particular thing, you're going to be fine 30, 40, 50 years from now when you're ready to retire.
That's right. And I think that is something that all of us, maybe the government as well, in addition to the plan sponsors and also the asset management industry, you know, essentially we are asking people to, you know, we're giving them the tools and ask them to make investment decisions on their own. But we haven't done as much in terms of the education and the teaching of the people. You know, I can't even tell you how many times in my past as a plan sponsor that when we offer the hotline for people to call in and ask questions, you know, people still don't understand when the interest rate goes up, the bond prices go down. And so something as simple as an investment concept is, you know, what we consider as is investment 101, that is not there for the participants. And so if we are asking people to make investment decisions, then we need to equip them with the tool and education for them to do that. And if we're not going to do that, and I think that Target Date Fund needs to do a better job so that they can truly be the set it and forget it investment option. But right now, I don't think that it is, I don't think it's appropriate to call it kind of invest it and forget about it, because if you do forget about it, you know, there might be challenges that come that might cause you by surprise, and we don't want that.
Absolutely. One last question before we end the segment. As a portfolio manager for C-Corp and a former plan sponsor, you made the point earlier about managing the risk and professionally managing the risk. Does that include, you know, when you look at a pension plan, for example, they have access to other types of investments beyond just their traditional asset classes. Does that include outside of, more private markets like private equity, other types of strategies? I just named private equity not to make a recommendation, but just to say, is that something that, like in a pension plan, is being used by many plan sponsors to diversify the portfolio? Are those things that should be at least considered when creating and evaluating and new investment products?
I think that there are many things that we can do before going into illiquid alternatives. And I know that has been a controversial area. And I think one of the reasons why people wanted to have diversification is to increase the investment return. You know, you definitely don't want to diversify for the sake of diversification. And because of the current governance issues around the 401k, I think that it's going to be extremely challenging from a plan sponsor's perspective to want to tolerate that risk. So maybe baby steps, that would be more appropriate in my view. That's fix the things that we definitely can fix. And maybe we're not going to get to our ideal target day fund in the first go, but if we can make incremental improvements along the way, I think that would be helpful. And so I would think that from an end-user perspective, and when I call it my Christmas wish list, it truly is a wish list, because it's a very long list of things that we all want to have. But in order to be practical, we might need to prioritize the things that we want. And to me, I think the more higher-level priorities would be risk management as we enter sort of the tail end or eighth or ninth innings of this bull market. You know, how do we introduce better risk management to the target day fund will be higher on my list. And the second one, as you mentioned, the communication and education for people who are actually using these target day funds so they know what they own. That also would be very, very important. And I think we're introducing additional risk of illiquidity and also governance risk from a plan sponsor perspective. Perhaps that's something that we can solve in the next generation of target day funds.
Very thoughtful list. Gretchen, Ty, thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting white paper. Again, you can check out the link to her and C-Corp's white paper at the right below this the posting of this show. We thank you so much, Gretchen, and maybe we can check back in with you and your team later on in the year to see if you have any other thoughts with regards to target date funds.
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's been fun.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Perfection is perfected, so I'm a lad, I'm understand. From a young G's perspective. And before me, they got a trick, I have to find a contraceptive. You never know, she could be earning her man and learning her.
Welcome back, and now it's time for our Millennial Money segment. And joining us now is the founder of Millennial Money, Mr. Grant Sabatier. Hey, Grant, how are you, bud?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing well, and, we're getting closer and closer to the book launch, and how do you feel? Are you excited? What are the emotions going on right now?
Yeah, I'm really excited. I mean, this is something that, I've spent the past 2 years writing, the past kind of eight, almost 9 years living, and the early feedback from the book from, publications and early readers has been overwhelmingly positive. And so I'm really just excited to get it into people's hands, because I know how stressed people are about money. And that's really what it's all about, just, learning that money's not complicated and how you can make more money in less time. So I'm more excited to get it into readers' hands than anything else. And I feel a lot of love already coming back from them, and it hasn't even launched yet.
Awesome. So checking in with you this week, you know, I know that you're, you know, booking appearances, you're already doing appearances, you're talking about the book, but what's top of mind for Grant Sabatier and the folks at Millennial Money this week?
Yeah, a lot of my readers are asking me when I think a recession is going to hit. You know, I'm getting that question, you know, 20 times a day at least. And, you know, they want to know specifically because they're like, you know, should I be investing in the stock market? And my answer is and will always be in the same. Investing is a long-term game. And in fact, I actually think for many younger investors, a recession would be the best thing ever that could happen. Simply because there'd be more values, and there already are more values out there, and especially when investing in the entire stock market. So early and often, and keep investing. Don't let the recession or any of the news scare you. Investing for almost everybody should and is a long-term game. Don't freak out. Don't worry. So it's a lot of calming emotions. And then the other thing is, you know, side hustling is just blowing up worldwide. I mean, I've been side hustling for, you know, the past decade. I was one of the first people to write about side hustling. And I'm really excited to just see so many cool, creative ways that people are making more money in order to not only make more money to invest for retirement, but build the skills also that are going to be useful in the future. You know, most of the jobs in the future, in 20 years from now, they don't even exist today, but there are kind of tried and true ways to set yourself up for those jobs. And so I've been spending a lot of time talking about what those skills are and how to insulate yourself for an increasingly uncertain economy and world that we live in.
Let me ask you a question. I love that. And I don't want to get off that topic, but I want to go on a tangent for a second because you know, obviously you're a writer, you wrote a book, but also you write for the Millennial Money website, you have lots of readers. But let me ask you a question. Where do you consume? Because you mentioned don't get hooked in the financial, the news, the doom and gloom of the financial press, and I tend to agree with you. But where do you consume information? How does Grant Sabatier, forget, I'm not trying to brand all millennials, but how does Grant Sabatier collect information during the day, during the week?
So I actually don't do any collection of information really during the week. I have noticed there's – you only have so much time in the day and in your life, and I think you can often choose to be a consumer or choose to be a creator. I'm very much in the creative part of my life, so I'm spending a lot of time creating, less time, I would say, synthesizing, with the exception NPR every morning. It's what I wake up to. I get the news through the radio, old school. Actually, NPR is like super popular amongst like my fans, and so I listen to the radio when I'm making my coffee and getting ready. And then what I end up doing is a deep dive on Sundays. So Sunday morning is my sit down, read the New York Times, and read, you know, Fortune magazine, read the Atlantic, you know, read the New Yorker. Sunday morning is kind of my time when I dive deep into what's kind of happening in the world. And I find that once a week deep dive works best for me than like jumping on a website here or there, getting alerts, or even, you know, getting my info on Twitter. Occasionally, because I do use LinkedIn and love LinkedIn, I really like their kind of like cream of the crop news stories that pop up. And so I'll peek, you know, take a look at those because oftentimes it's targeted. So I'll learn about a new study about millennials. And so I'll consume a little bit of information that way. And then the final thing, as crazy as it sounds, I have an Android phone. Whenever I open up Google on my Android phone, like it automatically shows the trending topics in Google, you know, the shooting that happened today, or someone died, or something happened, and just peeking at those, occasionally something will pop out to me that I want to learn a little bit more about. Jack Bogle died yesterday. Huge fan of his, or the day before yesterday, huge fan of his. Saw that in my Google alert, clicked, read a little bit about it. But those are the ways that I personally consume information.
And that, I think that's really insightful for our listeners, especially those on the asset management and record keeping side, people that are generating content and want to reach people like you, because you know the assumption is, you know, just painting with a broad brush, is that people are connected to their phone, and you know, I think we're all individuals, right? We all consume information in so many different ways, and the fact that you're not, you know, you mentioned you're on your Google phone for once in a while, you see the trending information, but you're not out there like, you know, literally texting all day long, and you're creating and doing the things that, you know, Grant Sabati and Millennium Money are doing, maybe a little bit different than what people think.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm 30, just turned 34. I'm on the older side of the millennial generation, but I've found pretty tried and true that the habits that I have are somewhat of a predictor of how things are changing. And so even though like people in their late mid-20s are consuming information, I'd say in that more fragmented, on the cuff way, I do see the trend switching more towards intentional deep dive consumption of information. There's just too much. There's too much overload. And so being able to come to that information on your own terms instead of always having to receive it is an incredibly kind of empowering thing. And that's why I do the Sunday deep dive, because like I don't really have to pay attention as closely during the week, and I can focus more on creating, and then I can really focus on synthesizing, you know, on my Sundays. So
yeah, and I think that it allows you to digest information in a thoughtful way, and actually, you know, now you're digesting it on a Sunday with sitting down with your wife, having some coffee, breakfast, whatever, and then you can talk about the issues, and then they resonate, they percolate, and then your week, you're actually implementing things that maybe you assess the week before.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I also think there's a huge difference, even with content creation, in the short term and the long term game. Writing a book is obviously very different than writing blog posts. I've had to adapt, and I've actually shifted my blogging strategy after writing the book. And so I'm writing less, but I think the quality has increased. And interestingly, with my audience, you know, we live in a world where like the average, you know, news site puts out what, like, I think, you know, New York Times puts out like 3,000 pieces a day, or the Washington Post 3,000 pieces a day, which obviously broad net, trying to reach as many people. I've actually found now, once I got to scale, the scarcity principle works even better. And so if you send someone 3,000 pieces a day, you know, obviously maybe they're going to get every, you know, they're going to get not only overloaded, but they're only going to open one every so often. With me, instead of writing like three times a week, I'll write like once a week or every couple weeks. Then, you know, I'm getting a 78% open rate for those emails, because people are waiting to hear what I have to say, and they pay attention to it. Because I'm not overloading them, and I don't just overwhelm them with information. So they pay more attention, actually, the less that I write, which is something that I couldn't have anticipated or expected.
Yeah, that's kind of the opposite of what a lot of people think. I mean, I put out a daily, but I'm not really – and then I put out a weekly – well, we do the weekly podcast, which is some of my thoughts, but mostly others. And then I do a weekly video and a monthly docuseries, and I find that that – is enough, because if I did something every day, one, it would kill me. Because, you know, I mean, there's how much Jeff Snyder do people want to consume? Probably not that much. But they do want to hear what other people have to say, and I think that's a great medium to do that. And I'm completely I do not want to do like a daily television show. I couldn't – I don't think I can handle that. So, but Grant, you and I are going to see each other in person next week. Really looking forward to that. We don't want to give too much away to the audience, but certainly appreciate your input, your knowledge, and you sharing it with us this week on the Weekly Pulse. You have a great weekend, and enjoy the New York Times, New Yorker, The Atlantic, all those other periodicals on Sunday. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks, Jeff. Have a good day.
Thanks, bye. Unfadable, so please don't try to fake this, but back to the lecture at hand. Perfection is perfected, so I'ma let 'em understand from a young G's perspective. And before me, they got a trick, I have to find a contraceptive. You never know, she could be earning her mate and learning her mate. And at the same time, welcome back. And now it's time for our personal finance segment. Joining me now, a superstar, TV's movie star, you name it, from Market Watch, personal finance reporter, one half of the Market Watch combo, at least on this show, Mr. Jacob Passy. Hey, buddy, how are you?
I'm doing well. You?
Fine. Have you recovered? Have you been signing autographs the last week? What? Tell us.
The fame just went to my head. No, I've recovered. It's back to the normal grind this week.
Did you
fun still a fun yeah. week still, but
yeah,
but,
lots
I mean, lots of really great stories out there, but no new TV appearances to speak of.
Well, hopefully your fans. I know I posted it. I thought it was a great segment, and I'm hopefully your at least your in-laws and your folks liked it.
Yes, yes. Exactly.
So what's top of mind? What stories are you and the great Ali Melito covering this week? I know there's so much going on with the shutdown. You had a great segment last week. What's top of mind for you this week?
Yeah, so one thing I wrote about yesterday and today was an announcement that came out from MasterCard. So this is actually unrelated to the shutdown, but still useful to know. So MasterCard announced back on Wednesday that they are instituting a new initiative where they are basically requiring that merchants that accept MasterCard change their practices when it comes to free trials. So we've all been there where you sign up for a free trial for, you know, something like Blue Apron or Netflix or, you know, that Beer of the Month Club. And, you know, you forget about it. You keep receiving the product. But lo and behold, you check your credit card statement and, you know, you've been paying for the past few months because the free trial had expired and they had automatically converted you into a paid subscription. So this is something that a bunch of folks across the country are looking to address, and MasterCard is the latest. So they are now requiring that merchants, you know, do things differently. Merchants now need to get your approval at the end of the free trial period before they can begin billing you for a paid subscription. And this is starting in April. These changes go into effect with MasterCard, and merchants will now need to, you know, email and text a customer with information regarding, you know, how much the subscription will cost, when they're expected to pay, and very importantly, instructions on how to cancel a subscription, because, you know, this is another frustration a lot of folks encounter, which is, you know, you sign up for a service and then it's impossible to quit it. You know, you have to go here and there, you have to call them. You know, it's a whole rigmarole just to cancel, you know, a simple, you know, monthly subscription.
I was going to say, you know, I oftentimes when I do a trial, and I'm just giving you my, I don't know if this is the best practice, but I will put something in my, so say it's 30 days, and I just want to kind of feel it out. I will put something in my Google calendar or my Apple calendar, and I will with the link, so that I can opt out with the order number and everything. I don't know if that's a best practice.
No, that's a great thing to do, and that's something that all consumers should do when they sign up for a free trial. And it's also important just to even read the fine print of the of what you're signing up for, because, you know, sometimes, you know, the FTC has identified this before, but there are fraudsters out there who will make something seem like a free trial, and it's not really free. You know, you may already be, you know, especially if you're providing credit card information when you're signing up for the trial, be very careful, because sometimes companies will actually already charge you for the first month of the paid subscription, even though it's a free trial. So, you know, you definitely want to be careful. But and then it, you know, one other reason why this is so important that, you know, MasterCard is taking a look at this. Other companies, you know, Apple has made it easier to cancel subscriptions through iTunes, PayPal, Capital One. You know, a bunch of companies out there are looking at this. And in California, they've even passed a law to crack down on this. But you know, I spoke with one financial advisor, Dan Moisend, and he was telling me, you know, a personal story, because his father died last year. But before his father died, he had Alzheimer's, and what Dan and his mom kept finding was that his father kept on signing up for free trials and then forgetting about them because of, you know, his declining cognitive abilities. And so, you know, when you think of the fact that, you know, you could have, you know, elderly parents who might be signing up for things, forgetting about them, and then stuck with the bill, because it's hard to get refunds for these things, especially if you've received the products. Or kids, you know, this is a common complaint that parents have, where their kids will sign up for, you know, a trial of some sort of, you know, digital service, or for, you know, know, monthly credits for, you know, a video of a game, and then forget about it. And then, you know, a few months later, suddenly the parents seeing, you know, on their credit card bill that their kid has racked up, you know, hundreds of dollars in charges. So this is a major issue. Now, it's important to clarify that MasterCard's initiative is only applying to physical products to start. So, you know, makeup subscriptions, food subscriptions. It's not applying to digital subscriptions, which is a major concern for a lot of folks, you know, things like Spotify. Those types of charges add up really quickly. And experts, you know, who I spoke with said, you know, this is all well that they're cracking down on the whole, you know, free trial kind of bait and switch tactic. But another thing that's concerning is, you know, the way that consumers can, if they've, you know, knowingly signed up for a subscription service, can end up paying more than they expected, because, you know, currently a lot of companies won't notify you if the monthly fee has gone up. And so you may not find out until you check the credit card statement and see, you know, you paid $40 this month for your cable bill as opposed to $30. And, you know, that's the other thing, is so many things these days are now subscriptions. You know, your cable, you know, you don't think of it necessarily that way, but you're subscribing for cable, you're subscribing for the gym. So it's all adding up, and it's good to see that, you know, credit card issuers and banks are taking a look at this to protect consumers.
Yeah, I like that you bring this up, and you know, I am very religious, as we have talked both online and offline. I check my credit card religiously. I look at that thing and see what the charges are, if something doesn't look right. But, you know, two things. The first is, I had an issue maybe a year or so ago where I tried an online, you know, I row on a rowing machine. So I tried an online rowing studio that I could row along with. And I could not, for the life of me, get out of, get unsubscribed. It would not let me unsubscribe at all. So finally, I had to call my bank, which is Chase, and challenge it. And then they contacted the owner. So it was a whole bunch of rigmarole. The second thing, and I like that you brought this up, is the fact that phishers and spammers can, you know, often I got something yesterday that said, instead of Microsoft.com, because I use Office 365, it said, don't forget to re-up for Office 365. Look just like Microsoft, but the URL was Microsoft Online or -online.com. So it looked really close to, you know, a true Microsoft site. That's very dangerous, especially someone who is not as, you know, diligent about their finances or who their providers are.
Over the past 10 years, I think it was the FTC recorded that consumers had lost about $1.3 billion in free trial scams. And that's just the ones that those were just the companies that the FTC went after. So there's probably even more money that consumers have lost in scams that have yet to be uncovered. So it's, you know, that's the other reason to be wary and to be cautious, is because, you know, a lot of those scams will use, you know, fake celebrity endorsements, or like you just described, will brand themselves to look similar to a, you know, legitimate product. But it's, you know, definitely good to double check the URL, double check the fine print. You know, even call up the company. You know, if an offer seems too good to be true, it probably is. And you wanna, you know, you can call up, you know, Microsoft or Blue Apron or somewhere to be like, hey, you know, is this really a deal that you're offering? Because, you know, you might find out that it's not, and you might even find a better deal. You never know.
Well, you are truly, you've gone from TV star and now you're a consumer advocate, and I love it.
Well,
and
thank you.
Very, very important information. So hopefully folks took notes, and always appreciate your insight. Wishing you and Allie a great weekend. You guys enjoy it. Stay out of the snow. Stay warm this weekend.
Yeah, it's a good weekend to just sit in front of the TV and catch up on all the shows I've been missing.
So. On a free trial, and make sure you mark when if you're going to cancel it. So, Jacob Passy, always a pleasure. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
You too. Take care.
Well, folks, I'm so sorry to say that wraps up another episode of the Weekly Pulse podcast. Special thanks to Ms. Gretchen Tai. She's the portfolio manager with C-Core Asset Management here in New York City. And, Ralph, she had some really insightful comments, didn't she? Thank you to our contributors again for awesome, awesome insights into the world of technology, personal finance markets, retirement, so much more. And thank you to you, our audience, for your input, your listening. And what can I say? Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you next week right here on the Weekly Pulse Podcast.